Welcome to the Anxiety Summit. Today our topic is treating anxiety in an integrative medicine practice. I'm your host, Trudy Scott, food mood expert, certified nutritionist, and author of the Anti-Anxiety Food Solution. Today we have Rebecca Robb, PsyD, clinical psychologist and co-founder of Integrative Primary Care Associates in Portland, Oregon. Hi, Rebecca. It's such a pleasure to welcome you here today.
Hi, Trudy.
Really great to have you here. We actually met online recently and corresponded by email and then chatted on the phone. And then we actually met in person at the recent IMMH conference, Integrative Medicine for Mental Health conference. And it was so super to meet you in person and to give you a big hug.
It was lovely.
It was. And learn together and even have some fun together. That riverboat ride in San Antonio was just such fun.
It was great fun.
It was really lovely, and I'm just really pleased to have you here because I feel that you're going to be bringing a different perspective to some of the presentations that we have here on the Anxiety Summit, which is why I really wanted to have you on today.
Good.
So I'm going to go ahead and read your bio, and then we'll get right into the topic. Rebecca Robb is a clinical psychologist with 40 years of experience in the field of mental health. She holds a master's and a doctorate from the School of Professional Psychology at Pacific University in Forest Grove, Oregon. Her undergraduate degree is from George Fox University, Newburgh, Oregon. Dr. Robb's work in the community mental health system before and after graduate school prompted many questions about traditional psychiatric pharmaceutical interventions. Her dissertation explored the efficacy of dietary interventions for children with ADD-ADHD. In 2001, she co-founded an integrative healthcare practice. Her practice at Integrative Primary Care Associates in Portland, Oregon, is based on her firmly held belief that vibrant mental health is directly related to proper nourishment of the body, mind, and spirit. She recognizes the reciprocal and dynamic influence of biological, psychological, and social forces in illness and health. Dr. Robb's ongoing investigation of emerging treatment practices led to an examination of neuronutrition and diet. These practices proved to be a remarkably valuable complement to insight-oriented psychotherapy. Further study at the Neuronutrient Training Institute, founded by Julia Ross, MA, and author of the bestsellers The Mood Cure and The Diet Cure, established a foundation for her current protocols. She continually strives to expand her understanding and effectiveness through study and collaboration with multidisciplinary colleagues. Wonderful. Really great backstory. And I'd love you to tell me a little bit about your story and how you are where you are today. We've got a little bit of an idea from your bio, but I'd like you to just share a little bit about how you started asking these questions and got into this.
Well, clearly my experience in community mental health, working with chronically and persistently mentally ill adults, was very significant because the best tool we really had during those times was psychiatric medicine, some heavy-duty drugs. And I watched, because I was working on mostly in crisis departments, I watched where this medicine saved people's lives. I watched also situations where it didn't work. And then I watched times when the side effects seemed so awful that I just had to ask the question whether or not it was worth it. So going back from the very, very first of my work in mental health, when I was 25 years old, I kept saying there's got to be a better way. And when I then that's part of the reason I went to graduate school, because I thought I was going to find the answers there. Mm-hmm. And I found a lot of information, but I didn't find the answers I was looking for. And I returned to community mental health because I was pretty committed to working in that field. And the next time around, I did a lot of work doing psychiatric evaluations, and that often took me all over the place, but often into the emergency department. And I got to see what happens when you had access to blood tests, tox screens, when you saw patients who might be experiencing a psychiatric problem, but you could also have them medically evaluated. And I got to see that there was a lot of stuff going on. And because people go into the emergency department, because, you know, the job of the people in the emergency department is just make sure nobody dies, they don't address the subtleties of imbalances in somebody's blood chemistry and so forth. I didn't understand it all. But I would see people who looked kind of sick to me, and they'd have a lot of those H's and L's on their blood chemistry profiles.
Yes.
You know, and the doc would say, okay, they're fine to be released. And I'd say, aren't they kind of sick here? And he'd go, well, they can check with their primary care on Monday. And I saw a lot of women who, something that really struck me was women coming in perimenopausal. That was the time of life I was at, and I paid a lot of attention to women coming in who, yeah, they've been doing okay, and then kind of tanked. They were just in a, and I had to start asking the question of what was going on with them, perhaps with their hormones. How was that playing into these psychiatric crises, right? And what I know now that I didn't know then is the connection between serotonin and estrogen. I didn't understand that, but I knew it inside myself that really, really significant chemistry imbalances were going on. And when I was reviewing these ideas in my head, one of the stories that I remembered was an emergency department nurse that I worked kind of close with, and you know, because we were both kind of perimenopausal, you know, you discuss hot flashes and hormone replacement therapies and all sorts of things with women who are going through the same thing, and we talked about it a lot. And I knew she was taking quite a bit of estrogen, and she kept having these serious rounds of depression. And then I would hear about her being hospitalized, and I tried to get somebody's attention to look at perhaps she was being given too much estrogen. Too much estrogen is going to give you the same symptoms. It's not enough. And the really sad ending to the story is she ended up successfully killing herself through asphyxiation, and she died. Oh. And I really believe that there would have been a way to intervene in this situation if the right issues have been addressed, you know. Maybe not, but it's something that I can't forget, you know, I think about. So I started imagining, what if as a psychologist I could be connected with people who were looking medically at my patients? And I also remembered some research that had gone on in the 70s done by Kaiser, interestingly enough. And in this research, Nicholas Cummings, who was the head of mental health then at the time, they looked at the 15% of the top utilizers in the healthcare system at Kaiser. And they were all given 6 psychotherapy sessions. Isn't that interesting? So the top utilizers of the healthcare system were given 6 psychotherapy sessions, and that reduced their use of the healthcare system by 40%.
Wow.
Isn't that something? And I never forgot that study, and I interestingly got to meet Dr. Cummings at a conference a few years ago, and I was just like a kid, just ecstatic, because that study had been so meaningful to me to think about. This could be such a good partnership, you know, working in a medical setting and having the information that I could gain from being in that environment. So you can see where this is going. I began to think, we've got to stop compartmentalizing everything. Now, this was 20 years ago, and I think they have a much better understanding of multifactorial causes with you know, I felt I had limited tools to address all these multifactorial causes. So that's what moved me towards, carried me through this journey and through this search, you know, for where the right place to serve.
Right.
You know.
And I'm sorry to hear about your friend, the ER nurse. And,
yeah.
You know, it's good that these things make us ask these questions. I think it's really important that these things make us ask these questions. And we look back and we say, if only I'd known this or this, you know, when that happened. But it's part of our journey to get where we are. And I commend you for asking all these questions and wanting to make change so long ago, because there's people starting to make changes now and integrating now, but to be as open as you were that long ago is pretty amazing. And I think it's very interesting that you bring up the Kaiser study, because what you're saying is that people who are going to conventional medicine practices could also incorporate therapy and then be more effective, and then vice versa. So we could have this combination.
Absolutely.
Where we're benefiting. I love it.
Absolutely.
And then I just wanted to make one clarification for folks who may not have got the nuance of what you said, where you said the H's and the L's on the blood chemistry. That's the highs and the lows. I just wanted to make sure people understood that.
Right.
Okay, good.
Right.
So are we ready to talk about what integrative medicine is? Because what you did was co-founded this integrative medicine practice. And we haven't quite got to that yet, but once you realized that you wanted to stop compartmentalizing and you wanted to work, you know, with other practitioners, is that what your next step was to help co-found this practice?
Well, let me tell you, I am in nearly an ideal location as an incubator for this idea. Portland is sort of a hub of alternative medicine. And we have a medical school, a naturopathic college, and a chiropractic school at college, and we also have an acupuncture school that grants a doctorate. So we kind of percolate here, and every restaurant has gluten-free on their menu. So it's quite a place. And my first idea when I was at the mental health center was I kept imagining if only some of my patients could go to the outpatient clinic at the naturopathic college, how great that would be.
Mm-hmm.
It was a pretty wild idea, but that came to my mind. And so I called up the naturopathic college clinic, and I had a fabulous conversation with a person there. I don't even remember who it was, and they thought it was a fabulous idea too, and then began to list the obstacles of why that wouldn't work, starting with the fact that I was working in Washington just over the border, and my patients had Medicaid from Washington, and it wouldn't work in Oregon, you know. And he didn't think that they could reduce fees additionally. They already had pretty reduced fees, so there wasn't a way to provide free service. But we had this lovely conversation, and he said, I'm wondering if you would like to be a preceptor for the naturopathic college. And I knew that was something really important, and I said yes. I couldn't remember what it was. And so I made an appointment to go have a conversation about it. And en route to the appointment, I remembered that meant having somebody shadow me. And that wasn't going to work real well at the mental health center. But the conversation I had with the academic dean, she and I decided we were going to do a workshop on menopause, her being a naturopath, me being a psychologist. That was born out of that conversation, which was very exciting. And we also decided that I would come and do some lecturing to the naturopathic residents about crisis intervention and chronic mental illness and that kind of thing. So we forged not the relationship I was hoping for, but it was a good start. And I decided that that I didn't know what we should be creating, but I knew that conversation was a part of it. I knew we needed to talk. I knew we needed to have conversation. So I created a little residency rotation where I offered to the residents an opportunity to come and hang out with me one day a week for a month, so four different days. And then if they wanted to, I'd invite them to come do an overnight shift with me at the emergency department, which I felt working at the emergency department was fascinating. I just assumed anybody else would. They didn't all pick me up on it, which I was surprised. It surprised me. I thought they would. They said, what, stay up all night? I'm going, yeah. They didn't jump at it. But one of the naturopaths did, and she and I had such a dynamic exchange of ideas and conversation. And then she said, you know what, there's a pharmacist in town. This is really ironic, a pharmacist who is wanting to form an integrative practice. Isn't that interesting? A pharmacist. And he's funding it. And we have, she said, me as a naturopath, an acupuncturist, and I think you should join us. And so it was, the rest is history. That was in 2001. And so I started for the next year to work with them to create the practice that eventually we got a medical doctor and a nurse practitioner and so forth, and opened this practice with the cornerstone being a pharmacy, which was not exactly where we're at now, but it was a wonderful way to be able to start.
So in this practice that you opened in 2001, you had an MD, a nurse practitioner, yourself. Was the naturopath part of it as well?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And then the pharmacist.
The pharmacist, and we also had an acupuncturist.
Okay. Uh-huh. Interesting. Yeah. Very interesting.
Yeah.
Okay, so what happened next?
Well, we realized we weren't sure what, we realized we didn't really know what integrative care actually was. I promise you, if we sat 10 people in a room and asked them each to define integrative care, there wouldn't be a uniform definition. Because we don't have clarity on what the definition of integrative care is. Some people think that a provider, some people call themselves that they do integrative care, they're a single provider who has a diverse education. Right? And they draw from multiple disciplines, and then they, as a sole provider, integrate the care that they provide. Okay?
Okay.
Yeah. We call that integrative care. Sometimes there is a location that has a sign over the door called integrative care, and if you go in there and there really isn't much more happening than multidisciplinary people who are just sharing the space. They're just kind of lumped in there together.
Okay, yeah.
And they maybe cross-refer, but, you know, it's just one-stop shopping is all.
Yeah.
And what we envisioned was that we would coordinate care together and that we would have we would work collaboratively with each other. And we would have case conferences and decide the best way to provide care for an individual patient. And, of course, and we'd all be in the same location and, you know, have the same front desk and all of that. Our charts would be in the same spot. And it all sounded like a gloriously wonderful idea. But it's not as easy as it sounds, believe it or not. It's complicated.
Yeah. Well, we're going to hear about that in a second. So I wanted to just go back to your comment about this definition of integrative care, because I attended the ADAA, Anxiety and Depression Association of America, and heard some people in the therapy world talking about integrative care being therapy and biofeedback, for example. So, you know, when I'm thinking about integrative care, I'm thinking about nutrition and nutrients as well. So you're right, everyone has this different definition, and I'm interested to hear what the next steps are that you're going to talk about on how how you can do all of this together. And before we do that, I just wanted to share that this dream that you had of all working together is exactly how things worked when I worked at Julia Ross's clinic, because I spent 2 years working in her clinic. And it was a really great collaboration, which worked so well for the client. There was Julia and another therapist. There was myself and another nutritionist. And then there was a doctor, and then we made referrals out to dentists if needed, and referrals to psychiatrists as needed as well. And I think that's quite an unusual situation and setup, but it worked really well. It worked well for us. We would meet, you know, once a week and talk about different clients and try and figure out problems that might be going on and try and work together to try and solve the issue. So it was great. It really was. So I'm very interested to hear what you can share about what you're doing and the difficulties that you've said that you see in building this integrative medical practice.
Well, see, you're exactly right, Trudy, and you know that I've spent time in that clinic, so I know exactly what you're talking about.
Yes, because you went down and trained with Julia, correct?
Yes. And so I know exactly what you're talking about, and you're right. That was the kind of thing we were imagining,
mm-hmm.
Is that each patient would be able to avail themselves of the various different disciplines that were available. And the first biggest obstacle we came up against was payment. Now, Julia has some star quality, and so people often came, sometimes from great distances. You know, when I was there was a woman who had come from Greece. I'm not kidding. And I helped her carry her suitcase up the stairs. This is no joke. I'm not kidding you. I helped her carry her suitcase up the stairs. And later, Julia said to me that she had come from Greece. I said, Greece? I heard her mention L.A. I thought that was the long ways. But she had literally come from Greece. So people had come to sign on for this whole protocol, you know, that you all did there. For us, what happened is we may have had offerings of multidisciplinary people, but people's insurance didn't cover it. They weren't necessarily coming as private pay. And we were just presenting ourselves as a primary care, you know. And people didn't walk through the door thinking, I'll move from provider to provider until I get the whole package. And doing that requires a unitary protocol. So that's what you had in your group. You had one program that people move through.
Mm-hmm.
When you're in a primary care, some people come with a hurt knee and some other people come with a hurt heart. You know? And we didn't have one protocol for everyone. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Because they didn't necessarily need all the same thing. But people were coming to you for Julia's protocol. So that's one of the differences right there at the beginning. And then we're still up against the issue of payment. We now have a biofeedback therapist, an acupuncturist, me, and then the rest are medical providers. Well, most people's insurance covers the medical providers because we try as much as we can to get everyone on the same panels. But an individual policy may not cover an acupuncturist, or an individual policy may not cover biofeedback. I think that's one of the reasons why psychologists are ideal working in a medical setting, because most people's insurance cover the medical issues, and they typically cover mental health as well. So that works nicely together for sure.
Right. Yes.
That works nicely together.
So is that what you've got with your practice now? Tell me where you're at with your practice right now.
Right now what we have is we have a medical doctor. We have two nurse practitioners. We have a physician's assistant. Not all of them are full-time. So a physician's assistant. physician's assistant. I'm there as a psychologist. We have another PsyD who is giving some of her residency hours in our clinic, although I'm not her supervisor, but she's getting a few of her hours in our clinic. And then we have a biofeedback therapist and an acupuncturist.
Okay. And no nutritionist?
Well, our medical doctor is a functional medicine. That is her approach. And she and the physician's assistant, the physician assistant, actually, now that I'm thinking about it, she has training in functional nutrition.
Okay.
She's relatively new. But we don't have a nutritionist. Mm-mm.
Okay.
No, we don't. But, the obstacles that we additionally came up against, so you all had this protocol where people were coming to meet with Julian and get the rest of the services kind of as a package deal. But when somebody comes through our door, they might initially come to see me, they might initially come to see one of the other providers. And so when we would talk about working in a collaborative way, there becomes the question of who becomes the case manager. That's pretty interesting, right?
Yeah. So how do you handle that?
Well, typically, it has become much easier now that I'm working with a medical doctor whose way of thinking about things is with functional medicine. There isn't so much variation in the way we look at things. But now the way it goes, and I've been doing this now since 2001, we pretty much respect the initial provider that the patient came to see. So if I'm the first stop, if they come first to see me and say I refer to one of the nurse practitioners who's actually a vegetarian, and I'm not a huge fan of a vegetarian diet, I'll sit down with her and talk to her about the reasons why I think if she's going to be working with her medically, that say the vegetarian diet I don't think is optimal for this particular patient. So we negotiate, and there's a lot of respect back and forth in that kind of way. For example, one of the other nurse practitioners would have been more inclined to prescribe psychiatric medicine than would have been my choice. But over the years, we've gotten to a place where when I think that's going to be his direction, I can sit down and propose my plan first and negotiate because that patient came from me. So that's what we've come to. But when we first started out, it was a lot more complicated. The allopathic providers, the medical providers who come into the practice were looking at themselves as a medical director, and that they were going to be dictating how the care was provided. So that was interesting. That was really interesting to navigate, you know?
Yeah, it sounds like it. And then just going back to what we talked about a second ago, because I was thinking about it while we were having the rest of this discussion, is that having a nutritionist in there, when you were talking earlier about the insurance, that could be a block there, because a lot of nutrition work would not possibly be covered by many people's insurance. So I could see why having someone else on the team whose services might be covered may be a better fit. So I was just sort of thinking about that.
Yeah, that's why we integrate nutrition. I integrate it heavily into my work.
Yes,
Dr. Perkins integrates it heavily into her work.
Yeah, good.
You know, that's why we do that, because it ends up being paid by insurance. Yeah.
Yeah, makes sense. Okay. So do we want to just talk a little bit about this incorporation of the neuronutrition into the psychotherapy practice? Because it makes sense to talk about that now. But I first want you to define what neuronutrition is.
From my standpoint, for me, I think I use those words to describe the way in which I use supplements, specifically amino acids, although I'm starting to use lithium orotate, and vitamins and supplements, you know, vitamins and omega-3s, that kind of thing, how I use those supplements and how I use dietary change and adjustment to affect mental health issues or to treat mental health issues. That's what I mean by neuronutrition.
Okay, great. And I'm just, it's so wonderful to have met you and to know that there's people like you incorporating neuronutrition into a psychotherapy practice. It's just so wonderful to hear. It really just thrills me.
Thank you. And it's exciting for me, too, because I will tell you, any therapist can describe to you, and I can go on and on about what it's like, for example, to be sitting with somebody who's quite anxious and spending your time on deep breathing exercises and the kind of tools that I have traditionally been offered as a psychologist, and yet here's this other tool where we can calm the patient's body. And once they can get more of their physical symptoms under control, the level that we can go at in a psychotherapy realm is very exciting. People come in to see a therapist and then kind of push you away because it's too scary to deal with grief. It's too scary to deal with the hard stuff. They're afraid to become more depressed or more anxious or more. But when we can get the physiological symptoms more under control, we can go to really deep places and make wonderful progress from a psychological standpoint. So I do it so that I can do my work better, you know. That's why I'm so attracted to it. I watch people be able to grow more than I could ever imagine them growing with us just using the traditional tools of psychotherapy.
Wonderful. I love it. So what about, you mentioned to me that you've got this basic protocol that you work with, and nutrition is one part of it. Tell me about what the other aspects of your work is. Obviously, therapy is part of it, but just give a recap of what you would sort of think about when you're working with someone.
Well, I think about, and I present this to my patients. I say that we have basically four tools. I really believe the most healing aspect of a therapeutic endeavor is the relationship that's established between the patient and the therapist. Mm-hmm. I feel that's at the core. And so I announce that to my patient, and I say, we've got to get to know each other. We've got to be comfortable with each other. We have to, because this is going to be at the core of our work. Then, and I don't think that's such a remarkable idea. I think it's shared across many disciplines, but particularly in most psychotherapists think the same. Then I believe that education is huge. Just understanding about ways that your body works, just understanding about developmental phases of life, just understanding about grief, just having information, so education, psychoeducation, information. Then nutrition, this idea of the neuronutrition that I already talked about, and psychotherapy. Insight is helpful at times, but I find it, well, I already said it, we can just take it so much further when we address the other things, when there's a good, strong relationship, when there's been some exchange of just plain old information, and when we have done things to nourish the brain chemistry, the psychotherapy is much more productive and goes faster. Sometimes patients don't stick. Sometimes patients, when they're feeling better, they go, oh, you know what? I can do this. I'm okay. And I've got your number, and I'll check in when I need to. And so, you know, they don't stick around for 2 years or, you know, long extended periods of time, which is very interesting. And especially I have lots and lots of 20-somethings in my practice, and they often come and get a few tools, and they're off, you know. It's great.
Wonderful, because you're addressing some of the nutritional deficiencies, like low levels of omega-3s, or as you say, some of the brain chemical imbalances,
mm-hmm.
or the fact that they've got a food intolerance or something going on with their gut. And I think this would be a great time to talk about some case studies of people that you've worked with. And I know, you know, we've got quite a few that we want to cover. Is this a good time to go into that?
That's fine. Yeah.
Okay.
Fine.
Let's talk. You have a woman that you worked with, a 24-year-old female with anxiety, and I'd love to go through some of the things that you did with her. Let's start with, you know, her background and what was going on, and then let's talk about some of the food changes and some of the nutrients that you recommended.
Okay. Well, she came to me with tremendous anxiety. And she told me she'd always been an anxious child. So, of course, when I hear that, something goes off in my brain that makes me think gut and, you know, chemical imbalance. And when somebody talks about this type of going on for a long time, I get kind of excited because I think, oh, good, you know, we can anticipate a good response, a likely good response to doing cleaning up some digestive issues and addressing some neurotransmitter issues. Her mother had been diagnosed with bipolar disorder, so she sort of assumed that they were just a family that had mental health problems. You know, she was she'd inherited it, and of course, in some ways, she had in terms of her digestive issues she probably had, but she said she really got hammered with the anxiety when she went abroad to study in Tokyo, and it was great at first, but then she started having money problems and she started to feel homesick, and then the earthquake. Remember that earthquake? What year was that? But that really bad earthquake in Sendai happened, and that was a good enough reason for her to come home, and she was home within 3 days. And absolutely obsessing about the earthquake, immobilized by it.
Sure.
She wasn't particularly hurt. She wasn't particularly anything. But when she could stand back from it over time, she knew it was the one thing that gave her a reason to leave, and she used that.
Mm-hmm.
So she described being sort of immobilized for 3 months, leaving school, moving back in with her family. And then that was a whole another list of problems because her family was stress. It was a stress-laden environment. And so she didn't really fall in to the arms of comfort and healing. She just sort of revved up the distress. And the days when she was the most distressed, her anxiety about the earthquake was really bad. And she could tell it was a little bit nutty, although I must say we do have a earthquake fault that runs through the Pacific Northwest, and so it's not completely nutty, but still to be so disabled by it.
Mm-hmm.
So interestingly, it wasn't that brought her into therapy. What brought her into therapy is she got a boyfriend.
Mm-hmm.
And I just fell in love with this girl the day she walked in. She says, you know what, this is a new relationship. She says, it's actually my first, but I think he's a really wonderful man, and I want this to go well. And so I want to address these issues of anxiety so that I can be healthy in this relationship. Isn't that cool?
Lovely.
I know, I loved it. So I said, all right. So because of her, you know, long history, I did offer information about, I started out offering her information about amino acids and suggested she read a little bit out of Julia's book. And she said it, she was pretty cynical about the whole thing. But to go along with the program, she would do that. She came back the following week, and she did a symptom checklist, and we decided we'd start with a trial of tryptophan. Now, do you supplement with multiple aminos at once, or do you use just one at a time? How do you do that?
I like to do one at a time because I think it gives a person a feel for what may be working. And certainly if someone is like this young woman that you're talking about and she's a little bit skeptical, I think it's nice for people to feel, yes, it is actually working. I am noticing something. Do you find that that's the case too?
Yeah. Yeah, I do too. And I remember when I was training with Julia, she'd send people out, you know, with a bag full of quite a few, you know, all at once. Of course, if they had to go back to Greece, I guess they had to take them with them. But I like to go kind of slow.
Mm-hmm.
And so I do one at a time, and hopefully we get a good result with the first one. So then we build a little trust, and then we build a little curiosity. And, you know, we're building this relationship. I love it if I can send somebody out the door in the first session. It doesn't, sometimes it's not till the second, but so I sent her out with a trial of tryptophan because of her, her sleep was pretty messed up, and I am very pleased when somebody can get a benefit from their sleep because it changes many things if you start sleeping better, many things, and plus it's very concrete. You know, you can't always say, oh, I didn't obsess as much as the day before because you can't remember how much that was anyway, and it's kind of vague. But, boy, you know if you start sleeping better. So
that's interesting that you say that, because I'll have my clients rate, you know, think about how much you're obsessing this week, and they'll give it a scale on 1 to 10, and then they'll say, yes, it was definitely less than the previous week. So
mm-hmm.
I'll have them look at all the questions and all, you know, whichever ones that score high and have them measure a few. We'll decide, you know, which one works. But I agree, sleep is an easy one because sometimes when you're in the throes of it, it's hard to remember how much did I worry or how obsessive was I or how irritable was I, all these low serotonin symptoms. Can we just go through a few of the low serotonin symptoms for people who may not be aware of what some of them are? And you mentioned the symptom checklist, and I just want to clarify for folks who may not know that there's this amino acid questionnaire that Julia Ross developed that is very effective for figuring out which deficiency someone may have. So can you just go through some of the other symptoms of low serotonin?
Sure. We think about, you know, depression, low self-esteem, obsessing behaviors or thoughts. Help me.
Anxiety.
Worry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, irritability. Rage. Yes, rage. PMS symptoms as well.
Right.
And then, of course, the afternoon and evening cravings. That's a big one with low serotonin.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right.
Got it. Okay.
And then, because serotonin makes melatonin,
mm-hmm.
in that same section, we look at sleep. And so what I look at is if the initial low serotonin symptoms have high numbers, and there's a lot of sleep disturbance as well, I can generate a hypothesis there that tryptophan could be assist with sleep. I have had the experience where the other low serotonin symptoms were low numbers, and then my hypothesis became sleep. The sleep problem was coming from a different place. It wasn't coming from low serotonin or a melatonin involvement.
Great. And I'm glad you made that clarification because, you know, we're talking about the amino acids and they truly are amazing. I call them the amazing amino acids because the results are fantastic. And as you say, people, we want to give them that feeling of hope and trust that, you know, that we're finding a solution for them and that we get results so quickly if they are going to work. But as you say, if the sleep is because of high cortisol or gut issues or something else, then the tryptophan is not going to work, which is not a terrible thing. It just means you've ruled out the fact that it's low serotonin, and now you can move on to find the other cause of whatever the whatever is causing the sleep issues.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
exactly. So, and you can get a hint of that by looking at the checklist. It is a little bit funny, I always think, to give a number to a feeling. You know, it is, you know, like, what's a number eight worry?
Yes, I know. And you're right. A lot of people battle with that and they just have to. And for some people, they've never not worried or they've never, you know, not had good confidence. So they don't actually know what they could feel like. So for some people, their numbers may not be quite right. But I think it's useful to have that number. I certainly find it's useful for them to log, you know, in the week log that they're doing once I send them home, and I'm sure you do the same, where they log their food and how they're feeling and to log it because come the end of the week, it's hard to remember. And then looking back on that in 3 months' time, they can look and say, wow, look how far I've come, which is very, very helpful. But you're right, looking at it from a number point of view sometimes pretty challenging.
It's kind of funny, and some people get really, you know, tied up in that. And I just say, don't overthink it.
Yeah.
Try to communicate with me that worry is more of a concern to you than irritability. You know, so irritability will be a lower number than worry. You know, just pretend like you're just try to communicate it to me. I'll clarify it with you.
Yeah.
I also run into sometimes men that I'm suspicious they're underreporting because I figure if a man got into my office to see a psychologist, he's distressed. And then I give him a symptom checklist, and everything's kind of low, and he's described the stress to me. So then I go, +5. Then I look at it from that.
I would agree. I find the same, because men, just they're not used to sharing their feelings, and it's hard for them to actually communicate that. And the fact that they've actually come in, as you say, is a big deal, because they're often not willing to admit that they've got an issue and that they need help. And you know, you're right, we need to help them gauge what the issue is. So let's go back to the client you're talking about, patient in your case. So she tried the tryptophan, and it helped her sleep.
It did. So she was a happy camper. And so we got a bump up on the trust scale and the cynicism about the supplement. She was ready to move forward the next week, which was great. So the next week, our conversation was about how emotionally porous she was. She spent a lot of the session telling me about the emotional burden that she felt for her mother, whom she observed as being not treated well by her father. And she was carrying such a burden of sadness for her mother's distress. And it was like she was carrying it in her body, you know, this distress for her mother. So we talked about emotional sensitivity, and I always tell people I think sensitivity is one of the greatest gifts from God, and that if people say, oh, you're just too emotional, I really challenge that. It's not about being emotionally sensitive. It's when that sensitivity is causing great distress for you. I want to see people be able to use their sensitivity as a wonderful creative tool of service in the world. So I told, and when people say, oh, you're just too sensitive, and then they're given some kind of medication to blunt that sensitivity, we've wiped out the gift, you know? Mm-hmm. So I suggested that she try D-phenylalanine and that week, and I started talking to her about her diet. And the way I start with somebody who's a little bit hesitant in that department is I tell them I want to eat, and them to eat protein, veggies, and fat, you know, basically a paleo-style diet at every meal. And then I hand them out some guidelines from a paleo. Actually, I use Practical Paleo has about 6 beautiful handouts that talk about a really great list of paleo foods, a page on sugar, a page on gluten, a page on fats, a page on cooking with fats, and there's another one. I can't remember the other two, but anyway, they're lovely handouts. And so I say we're going to use the crowd out approach. We're going to have you doing some good things with your diet as you're feeling better. You'll want to do more of those and less of the things that you're learning aren't helpful for you. So she started with a DPA, and she started, and she wasn't, she was back and forth between her boyfriend's house and her house and school and, you know, not even eating regularly. These 20-somethings don't get it about eating regularly. I just don't get it at all. And so just the idea sometimes of having 3 meals a day, each one containing protein, vegetables, and fat, changes things up in ways you can't even imagine. That simple.
I know. Isn't it amazing? And
yes, it's remarkable.
It is remarkable.
And I can't tell you how many 20-somethings are, well, they feel invincible and imagine that I don't know, just don't know how much that's impacting them. So anyway, so I started talking to her just about doing that simple thing and taking the DPA. And then we were able to proceed through some therapy. So basically, in terms of neuronutrition, we did tryptophan, DPA, and focused on her eating a paleo-informed diet, meaning integrating as much as she could from that kind of a dietary approach. And we were able to proceed with therapy swimmingly. I mean, it just went very well. We focused on family dynamics, on her new relationship. We were even able to address her habit of prioritizing the needs of others over her own needs, and how that then ended up being a source of anxiety for her, and we were able to address other sources of anxiety. We talked about the difference between the anxiety she felt watching a scary movie and, you know, anxiety that might actually be important for her to listen to. I think there's such a thing as healthy anxiety. I think when taxes are due on Friday and we haven't prepared our taxes and we're anxious, we need to be anxious.
Yes.
You know, that's healthy anxiety. And I teach my patients about identifying the difference. And when I say, when you're anxious about something and you go, that's kind of nutty, you know, I can promise you that that kind of nutty anxiety is coming from physiological imbalance. I can't promise that you will never have anxiety. There's going to be times when you need to be a little anxious. It's a busy street. You need to pay attention.
Yes, exactly.
But that anxiety that doesn't serve you doesn't let you move forward in your life. It can be immobilizing for some people.
And did the tryptophan help with some of that anxiety as well?
Yes, she was able to, over a course of 12 sessions, those 12 sessions stretched out over 3 months. By the end of our time together, she was finishing up school. She was getting ready to apply for grad school. She was getting ready to move in with her boyfriend. And her anxiety was under control. She considered it to be under control. And at the end of when she said, you know, I have all these things on my plate. I think I'm going to be cutting back on my therapy. You know, I'll call you if I need to. I said, so what do you attribute this recent interpersonal growth? What do you attribute it to? And she named the DPA, the D-phenylalanine, the DPA, education about anxiety, what was causing it, where, you know, and insight and understanding about her own personal coping strategies. So look at that. I mean, the neuronutrition, the education, and the insight. And I didn't prompt her.
That's great. That's really
that was
great.
That was her list.
And I'm glad you brought up the protein, veggies, and fat. And I wanted to just reiterate the name of the book that you'd said, Practical Paleo. It's by Diane Sanfilippo. And we're going to have a blog post that'll go with this interview. So I'll make sure that we put that on the blog post. And then that earlier study that you talked about, we'll put that on there as well, and we'll make sure that the amino acid questionnaire is on the blog post as well, just so folks can look at it. And, of course, I'm my talk going deeply into each of the amino acids will help a little bit more for folks who
Excellent.
May not be familiar with this. But I wanted to have you talk, you know, about how your practice works, how you've got there, and how you're incorporating this and how it's helping with the therapy sessions. I think it's just
mm-hmm.
wonderful. As you say, it's adding to it and just making it more effective. And look at those few simple nutritional changes that you made that was enabled her to have such good results. Really, really wonderful.
Yes, and look at this. We're talking about 3 months of therapy. We're not talking a year, 2 years. We're not talking 3 months, 12 sessions. You know, I used to poo-poo the idea of short-term therapy, but a 20-something is not doing deep life review, trying to figure out how to navigate this beginning to be an adult stuff. What I love about it is I think of them as little sailboats, and they're kind of adrift, right? And I work with them to adjust that sail just a little bit with these things that we're talking about, and they're off. You know, it's a very exciting image for me. And then every once in a while, they'll be back, and we'll take on the next project. But I love working with 20-somethings. I think it's a very exciting group. And, by the way, let me say this. Are you familiar with the book, The Defining Decade? Do you know that book?
I'm not, no.
Oh, let me tell you about it. Anyone who's working with 20-somethings, Meg J. is the author, The Defining Decade, and she talks about the fallacy of the idea that 20-somethings get 10 years to just kind of fool around and then figure out what they're going to do with their life. And she really challenges this notion. But beyond that, she does a beautiful job of mapping out what they should be doing. And she doesn't do it based on 10 years ago, what it was like to be 20-something or 15 years. She does it on what it's like to be 20-something right now. She talks about delaying partnering. She talks about cohabitation. She talks about the job market, she talks about student debt, she talks about all these very, very timely issues, and she gives ideas for ways of addressing them. It's a wonderful book. I think every 20-something should read it. I think every parent of a 20-something should read it. Every therapist who works with 20-something should read it. It's a wonderful book.
I love it. That sounds so great. And it's
Excellent.
So interesting that you brought this up because my current website is called Every Woman Over 29. And the reasoning behind that is that when you're in your 20s and younger, you think you're invincible and you can, as you say, you can fool around and not do anything. But
mm-hmm.
then you get to 30 and then you wake up and you realize, maybe I should do something. So that was the reasoning behind the name of my website. It's actually going to be changing, but that was the reasoning behind it because we feel like we're invincible in our 20s. And I love
yes.
that she's got the strategy that you can actually do something about it, not wait till you get to 30 and think, oh, my gosh, you know, I haven't been eating well. I haven't been looking after myself,
yes.
you know, all of these
yes.
other things. So what a wonderful idea. I will share that one on the blog as well. Thank you for sharing that.
You know, every once in a while, I'll look at my schedule for the week, and just for fun, I'll count, you know, how many 20-somethings are on my schedule. Do you know there are times when 50% of my schedule is filled with 20-somethings?
Wow.
Isn't that amazing?
sad. It's sad because I think we are seeing younger and younger, people in their 20s and even teens having problems needing support in the mental health world. And I think a lot of it has got to do with the diets that we've been eating. You know, we've moved away from basics. We've moved away from eating like our grandparents ate. And I think it's setting kids up, and it's we've got all these stresses, and kids under a lot of stress at school and to study, and money issues. So we've got a lot of factors that are contributing to it, and it's sad, and it's just wonderful that we can get them educated, with the work that you do, sharing that they just need to eat, throughout the day, and they need to eat healthy foods. I mean, just basic stuff like that can make such a big difference.
Oh, it's amazing. Yeah, and their bodies are young, so they're going to heal faster as well.
You're right.
Which is also, that's part of that setting the sail and off the go, because small things can just make amazing changes.
Yes, so. And two things that you said earlier I really love. One is the setting the sail analogy. I think it's lovely.
Yes.
And then the fact that you say they'll come back, because often we've got these predispositions. You mentioned that her mother had a bipolar diagnosis, which doesn't necessarily mean that, because it's in the family that you have to have it, but it means you've got these predispositions and you have to look after yourself. You have to, things are going to come up that are going to maybe make you more prone to being stressed by something than somebody else, or maybe you've got some, inherited predispositions to nutritional deficiencies. So it just means that you can change it by taking care of yourself. You don't have to. It's not your destiny.
Yes, and let me tell you, this is another thing that happens with an integrative practice. As a psychologist, complete therapy. Terminate. You would end, okay, I'm not going to have therapy anymore. The therapist and the patient would agree. They have a terminate. I mean, we studied how to terminate therapy. You do a sort of formalized process of doing that. The chart is closed. There you go. Mm-hmm. In an integrative primary care, our charts don't get closed. We have electronic record keeping. My chart doesn't close. Now, I might chart in there. They're not going to be coming in for therapy now. But I also kind of keep track of people who are using our office as primary care. So if somebody comes in for their annual exam and they're having a tough time again, their primary care provider can say, hey, why don't you go back and see Dr. Rob for a while? Or why don't you go talk to her about that? I think this makes sense. Or how about, look, we see that your diet's kind of a mess again. Go spend some time with Dr. Rob. She can help you get back on track. And you have the luxury of seeing her every week for an hour. That's the luxury of a psychologist. The medical providers, now we have half an hour appointments, which is a luxury by many standards, and an hour for the initial appointment. But that's still not the hour every week that I can make happen when somebody's having a tough time. Mm-hmm. So people who have join the practice and use it as their primary care do come back and touch bases and see, we hope, our practice as their healthcare home.
I love it. Very nice. Yes, and that's how it should be. Mm-hmm. Now, I wanted to just make one point of clarification. We talked about tryptophan and DPA, and those someone wouldn't need to be on indefinitely. It's once they sort out the diet and the eating, they should eventually be able to get off those.
Well, the conversation I have is that, we don't know the long-term effects of these amino acids. But beyond that, if we continually, if we don't look for the underlying cause, I have to say, am I doing something different even than the pharmaceutical industry that's just making a compensation? I want the body to fix the problem, fix what had gone awry to cause this neurotransmitter depletion, and then to take care of it on its own. So, and that often ends up being my segue into the diet stuff is because let's find out what's at the core of this. Let's figure out your neurotransmitters are 90% of them are formed in your gut. So there's a good hypothesis that we've got to start there.
Right.
You know.
Yeah. I mean, making sure that they're getting adequate protein, so they're getting all the raw materials, and that they getting, as you mentioned, adding in this paleo diet, so they're getting a good source of all the cofactors from the beautiful fruits and vegetables that they're eating, and, you know, all of these other good things. So healthy fats, which help make the hormones. So all of these are important. And if she wasn't eating well or not eating frequently enough, she probably had blood sugar issues. So that's going to stress the adrenals, which is then going to have a ripple down effect. So as you say, getting to that root cause. But the wonderful thing about the amino acids, this neuronutrient therapy, is it gives people hope right away. She started to get results right away. She started to sleep better, which is going to have such an amazing impact on just overall health and energy and sugar cravings. And then, as you say, get to the root cause of the problem and address that. But I just love the aminos because people get results so quickly while you're digging deeper, because sometimes addressing the gut issues or food intolerances or some of these other issues can take a little bit longer.
Well, yes, and we are finding people with small intestine bacterial overgrowth, SIBO. We're finding people with different complex gut issues, and they take a while to address. And I don't do that. I have the other providers do that. The thing that's, it wouldn't be appropriate particularly for me as a psychologist to do that because it involves testing and so forth. But one of the things that's lovely about that is I have trained the other medical providers in our practice about using aminos. So they don't have to go to, for example, their primary care MD and then have a debate about whether or not they should be using aminos. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
That there is a continuity in their care because I trained that MD on how to use them.
Wonderful.
So she uses them according to Julia's protocols. And one of the things that I think is so difficult in today's healthcare system is that because everything's so compartmentalized, you may have to go to multiple providers and then get different messages from different providers. And then the patient is left to try to decide, well, Dr. A said this, Dr. B said this, and Dr. C said this. Who do I pick? How do I decide what is the right approach? And that's another benefit in integrative care. I can't promise you that I'm going to agree with absolutely every single thing that every provider in my office says, but I tell my patients, if you are told conflicting information, I want to hear about it, and we will figure it out.
Good.
You don't have to figure it out. We will work it out, and we will come to you with a recommendation that is reflective of the agreement we've negotiated.
And it's a good point you raise because I see it a lot. I'm working with someone and then they'll go to their doctor and I'll say, you know, your doctor may not agree with this. And then they're getting conflicting information. And it is difficult because there's so much conflicting information out there. And I can see that it's got to be challenging for our patients and clients who are being told all of these different things. So I love that you guys are all on the same page. Or if you're not, you come to some kind of agreement. I think that's important. Now, we are... This has been absolutely amazing. We had a few more case studies we were going to talk about, but we have run out of time. But I think what we've covered has been wonderful. I would love you to just say one more thing about high level about one of the others we were going to talk about, because the example we gave was someone who came in, responded very quickly, was open to trying the nutrients, and had very good results quickly. And it's not always the case. Sometimes it can take a little bit longer. So could you just maybe give us a 1 or 2 minute synopsis of someone else who it took a little bit longer to get similar results?
Well, I had a woman come to me when she was 28. She's now 31, but she was having tremendous anxiety and panic attacks, depression, mood swings, seasonal allergies. Immobilizing. She would, have to cancel on functions, and that she couldn't attend things that she wanted to go to and so forth. She came in very focused on the idea that her problem had to do with her relationship with her family, particularly her mother, whom she labeled as personality disorder, borderline personality, and that was her label for her, and that because that relationship was broken, she couldn't have other healthy relationships, and her anxiety and all of her functioning was related to her family of origin. And but she could describe to me, gut cramps and constipation. She could, give very specific gut distress, mm-hmm. But I couldn't get through to her that we needed to look more closely at her gut issues. And I gave her some tryptophan, and it was a little somewhat helpful, but honestly, the real changes started happening when she went to see the medical doctor in our practice, and her complaints at that time were GERD, epigastric discomfort, and there was testing, H. pylori, CBC, vitamin D level, and she got some education about gut repair. Mm-hmm. Eventually, and then Dr. Perkins, once she got her food intolerances worked up and eliminated eggs and gluten, mm-hmm. so that her gut got a little bit better, she worked on her diet a little bit, Dr. Perkins gave her cavanase. And once there was this work on her gut and the cavanase, she, it was a 20-something, that set her sail, and she was off. And she was off for, sailing solo for, probably about 10 months or so. And then came back, and she said, I was doing great, but then I started getting panic attacks. And so at that point, I gave her a metabolic assessment form that's put out by Dr. Karazian. I don't know if you know about him, but he's the chiropractor who wrote the book, Why Do I Still Have Thyroid Symptoms mm-hmm. When All My Tests Are Normal? I don't know if you know that book.
Yes, I do.
And do you know his metabolic assessment form? Are you
yes.
familiar with it at all?
I do.
Did you say I do?
I do, yes.
Yeah, yeah. So I use that often to try to get the attention of my patients that there's still more gut issues or more hormonal issues or more physiological issues that need attention. And so she took that and went back to see Dr. Perkins again, and at that point I was diagnosed with SIBO. And treating the SIBO was what really turned things around. She was responsive then to, I didn't give her, since the cabinase had worked before, I actually gave her phenibut, which is the form of GABA that's in cabinase, and she'd had a good response to that. Once she complied, when she had the antibiotic treatment and had started using the SIBO diet and so forth, things really turned around for her. And she's been able to, I still see her. I see her, maybe every 2 weeks or once a month. But she is growing up, and she's calm and focused, and she's made significant career moves, And she's had a remarkable resolution and individuation from her mom, and some boundary setting and really growth within her family unit. And it's just a joy to watch her grow. You know, she's now 31 and a lovely, beautiful woman. So, I don't know what else to say about that except for that it's a joy to work with her, a great joy.
Wonderful. And I'm glad we talked about this because it took longer to get the results. And you mentioned earlier the importance of gut, and it was gut issues that needed to be addressed. And, you know, along the way, you tried the tryptophan, that didn't work, and it may not always work. So addressing the gut issues, and I want to just clarify for folks who may not know what SIBO is, small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, which is where you've got good bacteria, but it's in the wrong place. It's in the small intestine, and it can cause some of the digestive symptoms that you talked about, and we've got to deal with it. Otherwise, we're not going to get anywhere. So that was, it was good to, you know, just have that little, you know, difference, because not everyone's going to respond the same. And then you talked about getting rid of gluten and eggs, and, you know, protein is wonderful, eggs are wonderful, but for some people, if they have got a sensitivity, it's going to cause problems. So
absolutely,
a nice little, just showing a little bit of a different approach that different people need. We're all unique. We've all got different things going on, and we need to get to the root cause of everything, as you were saying earlier, really important.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, we can't finish on this note because I have to ask you about Phenibut and GABA.
Mm-hmm.
So tell me what your thoughts are on those, because I'm not a big fan of Phenibut, and I'm just curious why you used it. Had you tried the GABA and not got results? Share a little bit about that.
Yeah, well, we found that people were responding much better to cavanase than GABA. And so we didn't know why, and we tried to figure out why that might be.
Mm-hmm.
And we investigated the ingredients in cavanase, and one of them was Phenibut. Do you say Phenibut? Is that what you say? Or Phenibut? What do
I
you
say Phenibut. Yeah, I say Phenibut.
Okay. All right.
What do you say?
And so I say Phenibut, but I didn't know what the proper pronunciation. But we investigated, and we found that in a number of combination calming supplements, it was used actually quite commonly. And so we started using it individually and getting really good results. We could dose very low with it. And people used it, actually could use it fairly sparingly. I actually dose pretty low with most things. If I have to go up pretty high with something, then my thought is there's obstacles in the gut that are keeping this from being absorbed and metabolized, so we need to go to work on the gut. I just don't push levels very high of anything. We've just had really good results with it. There is the whole discussion, which about the molecules of GABA being too large to get across the blood-brain barrier. And then there's the conversation about the fact, yes, that there's GABA receptors in many parts of the body. It's a very fascinating conversation. Mm-hmm. I just find the Phenibut effective.
Okay.
Tell me what are your concerns? Why do you not like it?
Well, there's a lot of research that's come out of Russia, and I had a question. You know, someone asked me about it, and I did some research, and there's this question, and there's research supporting it that you can develop dependence, and you can get, you know, you can have these withdrawal symptoms from it. So that's why I was concerned. And and I've had really amazing results with GABA. I use the GABA Calm, which is the sublingual, and find it to be very effective. And I agree with you. There's this whole discussion about it you know, crossing the blood-brain barrier, and maybe it's working with people because they've got leaky blood-brain barriers, and so they, and this, you know, the receptors in different parts of the body, and certainly in the blood vessels, and maybe it's working at that level. So it's just interesting to have a discussion. When I actually interviewed Dr. Michael Parsons for this summit in the Candida talk, she said that she's a chiropractor, and she says in the functional medicine chiropractic world, they're not as keen on GABA because they're concerned about what's it going to do in the brain if it does get into the brain. So it's an interesting discussion, and it's good that we're talking about it because I think hearing your experience is good, and that's my thoughts on it. You know what I would love
is anyone who has research or information about fenibut, I would love to gather that information together. I've found some, not a lot. I know what you're talking about, the dependence, but you figure that's on the GABA receptors, which are the ones that the anti-anxiety medicines work on. I think I would love to hear more conversation about this. What I tell my patients is I say, if you find anything that troubles you or is negative about these supplements, anything, send me the link. I want to know what's out there. I don't want to miss any of it. And so, and we have a far reach to do that. And I would love to hear what people know. We're just finding it pretty effective.
Well, it's good.
We're being very careful not to recommend it at high doses.
Yes,
so
and I know you.
Our guard.
And I know you're very careful with what you do, and you look into things. So I appreciate that, and it's good for me to learn from another practitioner what you're finding is effective. May I ask what kind of GABA that you have tried that you found was not effective?
You know what? I'm no longer the one ordering the supplements. I can't remember what brand we're using right now. You know, we order all of our aminos from TimCush. So,
yeah, it was probably GABA Calm. And there's a form of GABA called Pharma GABA that I have not found to be as effective. And yet, when I interviewed the doctor, the naturopath from Canada, he says that he's found good results with the Pharma GABA. So, I think, you know, if people are getting results, that's the main thing. And actually, when I interviewed Dr. Josh in the previous summit, he says he doesn't really mind what the mechanism is. The main thing is that you're getting results. You know?
I heard that.
And personally, GABA was a lifesaver for me. When I was having my anxiety and panic attacks in my 20s, it was amazing. It was incredible. So I've experienced it personally. So I think it really is an individual basis, and it's good to get this feedback. It really is. It's good to hear. Now, the fenibut, is that prescription or not?
No.
Okay.
No, Biotics has it. There are quite a few different supplement sources for it. There's I wish I knew the name of a compounded supplement that's just sold in our health food store just for relaxing that has fenibut in it. It's out there. I didn't know to be looking for it initially until we started to sort of try to tease it apart, the cabinets components, and that was so expensive, but people were getting such good results that I didn't want them to miss out.
We've got to see what people respond to and then go with that.
Yeah.
And ideally, what we would like is a bunch of research in this area. If we could get some studies together and do some studies, that would be wonderful, because we really do need more research with this, but certainly with GABA and certainly with some of the other amino acids. I think that would be wonderful. Maybe you and I can try and cook up something.
Well, you know, I know what the obstacle becomes with amino acids is, in my opinion, is it is such a individualized prescription that it's very hard to study something with a standardized dose. You see what I mean? Each
yeah.
person has to have a unique, I mean, you really have to treat each person individually. And so looking at a typical research model gets tricky when you're doing individualized medicine.
It is, because you're never going to have the same results across the board. That's why
yep.
when I see these studies and they say they didn't have significant results when everyone went gluten-free or everyone took, you know, did something,
right.
you're not going to ever see that because you need to actually say, well, let's recruit these people into the study who have these deficiencies and then give them
yep.
this and see what the results are. So it is challenging.
Right.
I agree. Well, Rebecca, this has been fantastic. Really,
oh, I'm so glad.
Really amazing.
It's fun.
So glad to have you on. I'm so glad we got to meet and in person and then, you know, followed up and decided to have you come and share this because I think it's been very interesting and is adding another element of interest and another element of how we can move forward with some of these approaches and getting more integrative practices together and making treatment and making outcomes much more effective for our patients and clients, which is what we want. So
I really
appreciate
yeah.
it. I would love to have you give any last final words of wisdom.
Well, I just think that we need to be sharing information with each other. And when we're in different disciplines, we have different perspectives and our learning comes from listening and gaining common language. And these forums are so exciting because it's an opportunity for that. And I think it's thrilling what you're doing, and I am delighted to be a part of it. I really am.
Oh, I'm so glad.
Thank you so much.
You are welcome. And the listening component, there's another element to it because we need to listen to our clients. If they say
yes.
that they're getting results, like you
yes.
said, that they're getting results with this, then we need to look further. And we are course correcting all the time. We're not saying, well, this is exactly
yes.
what we do, and we course correct, and then we even do different things for different clients. We didn't even talk about some of the other things that can raise GABA levels, like theanine or taurine or glycine. So there's a lot of different approaches that we can use for different people.
Yes.
And it's been wonderful. Really, really great. Thank you so much, Rebecca.
You're absolutely welcome. Thank you.
And thank you for doing what you do. Thank you, everyone, for joining us for another amazing call on the Anxiety Summit. I look forward to hearing you on another great interview. This is Trudy Scott signing off.